In 2021, I had a conversation with brothers Mike and Robert Ashmore regarding a highly curious satellite image they discovered in a lagoon on an island that's gotten a lot of play in this Earhart investigation over the years. It's been some time since that interview, and the wheels of this case turn slowly, but they do turn. Tonight, in a follow-up to that episode, I welcome a man that has been on my radar for years. And over those years, we've talked off and on about him being a project guest, but we wanted to wait until just the right moment for him to make his debut. Fortunately, now is that moment, and we owe it all to that conversation with the Ashmore brothers from over 3 years ago. That satellite image they stumbled across? Now it has a name, and a True Blue expedition out to Nicomororo to investigate it. It's called the Turiya Object, and it's about to get the full investigative treatment. He's been name-dropped for years by multiple guests. Tonight, one of the most decorated archaeologists we've ever had on this show makes his Chasing Earhart debut to discuss a brand new expedition out to a very familiar place with an entirely new goal. This case has a way of bringing things full circle, and boy, are we completing one of those circles tonight. Welcome back to Chasing Earhart. From Eugene, Oregon, by way of the Archaeology Channel, this is Dr. Richard Pettigrew. Dr. Richard Pettigrew, this is a big honor, sir. I've said this offline. Welcome to Chasing Earhart, sir. I appreciate this.
Well, I appreciate the invitation.
Of course. This is a conversation I've wanted to have for some time, and now I think it's a perfect time to have it. Since this is your Chasing Earhart debut, we got to begin by asking you to answer the first two questions I ask everyone that's ever debuted on the show. Let's start with giving listeners a snapshot of your education, your professional background pre-Earhart, and we'll get to Earhart here next.
Right. Well, I'm a professional archaeologist, PhD archaeologist. I got my master's and PhD at the University of Oregon. I live in Eugene, so I've been here in Eugene for many decades. Mm-hmm. I've done lots of archaeology, you know, more than 50 years worth of archaeology, a lot of projects.
Yeah.
I've done many, many, many projects, excavations, publications, and so forth. So I'm thoroughly trained in the archaeological scientific method. I'm used to dealing with data, interpreting data. I bring that experience with me to this project.
Well, let's get into the topic of the night. This is always a fun question to start because everybody comes to Earhart from a different point of view, a different reason. Can you remember the first time you heard the name Amelia Earhart? Can you remember the first time you heard about this case in depth other than just a passing cursory knowledge?
Well, of course, I grew up knowing about the story, you know, as a kid, but I didn't have any expertise in the subject. Mm-hmm. I really got into it more in more detail as a result of my association with Dr. Tom King.
Who
was the archaeologist with Tiger, close associate of Rick Gillespie. Tom and I have been colleagues and friends for many decades, going back more than 30 years, probably.
Yeah.
And because I knew him and we had conversations on the subject, of course, I'm fascinated by the subject anyway. Mm. I have always been. But then I learned a lot more through him. And he has been to the island many times. I interviewed him for our own show. You know, we have our own media organization, Archaeological Institute.
Yes.
And we do audio interviews and video interviews. And we've had some of that up on our website, the Archaeology Channel, which is at archaeologychannel.org. So I got into that more than 20 years ago. I was already doing that kind of stuff with them. Mm-hmm. And I got more and more into it. You know, it's a mystery. It's a fascinating mystery. I love puzzles. I love looking at data and trying to interpret it, trying to come up with answers, solutions, finding patterns, and so forth. Over the years, I just maintained that association with Tom. We invited him to come to our film festival. We do an annual film festival here in Eugene.
That's right.
And he came as our keynote speaker, talking about the Earhart Project. I interviewed him and we put that interview up on our website and I got really interested and I kept trying to find ways to go with him to the island. I thought I might have a chance when they went in 2015. It didn't work out, but finally finagled a way to go along with him in 2017.
Yeah.
And that was my visit to the island. So I do have a direct experience being on Nicomororo, which is very exciting, very interesting. We gathered some new data and I'm still kicking that around, you know, looking at the information. That's, I guess, the answer. I've always been interested, but I really was drawn to this through Tom King.
Well, shout out to Tom King, who will hopefully return to the show. He's our very first guest. I have a lot of love and respect respect for Tom King. So Dr. King, if you're listening, hopefully you will be, we'll be in touch. So we originally had Mike and Robert Ashmore on the show back in 21. This was early in their campaign to sort of get some attention on this particular target. There are a lot of people that wouldn't necessarily place a whole lot of credence on something based on a satellite image, but now we've got a full expedition investigating that very same location. What was it about what Mike and Robert observed that made you think, well, hold on here, there may be something to this?
Right. Well, I was watching what was going on when they found it and they started spreading the word about it. You know, they got on the Tiger discussion about it. I was fascinated by it. I didn't know quite what to make of it, of course, at first. But I invited Mike to come to Eugene in 21. At that time, at our festival, we had a symposium devoted to the Amelia Earhart issue.
Yeah.
And so he came and gave a presentation. He was here directly. You know, I was able to speak with him directly and look at his information.
Sure.
Well, it was interesting enough for me that I got to thinking that, you know, this actually could be the Electra. Mm-hmm. And as a result, I pulled together some friends. We pooled our resources and bought a couple of dozen more satellite images. My interpretation of the object is based not on one satellite image, but on a couple of dozen.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, other evidence as well. So I guess that kind of answers your question. I followed up from him and gathered more information and have a lot more images.
Yeah, absolutely. Which leads us to what we're going to get into in some depth here tonight. Mm-hmm. Where this target lies is in a spot in the lagoon that leads to open ocean. And I've talked to Bill Snavely about this with Project Blue Angel and that aircraft wreck site out at Buka, and time being of the essence with that for different reasons. Does it concern you when it comes to time? Is this something that could drift and be lost at any moment?
It's something that I think could be vandalized.
Okay.
I'm not so much worried about natural processes because I think that it's firmly embedded in the sediment. My interpretation is that it became visible in 2015 when Tropical Cyclone Pam came through the Pacific. That was one of the most powerful storms ever recorded in the South Pacific. There was an immense storm surge that went for a great distance. It's recorded at least 1,000 kilometers away from the storm path. So, and we have visual evidence in the satellite imagery that the vegetation along the shoreline on the windward side was heavily damaged by that storm. So we know there was a storm surge. It was right after that storm that the object became visible in the satellite imagery.
Yeah.
So my interpretation is that the surge caused the water flow into the lagoon and the vortex, which forms there naturally as a result of the configuration, swept the sediment off the object and made it visible. After a period of about 6 years after that, then it became invisible again. And my interpretation is that the natural sedimentation resumed and the object was covered up again. The analogy I like to make is to a shipwreck on the beach. I think we've all seen examples, at least in the news, of shipwrecks that become exposed during a storm. And then after a period of time, the sand builds up around them and it obscures them again. They become invisible again. And I think that's what's happened here. I think that's the best explanation for what we have seen.
So Pam really just sort of showed us temporarily even a potential wreck site that maybe we didn't necessarily know was there or couldn't hypothesize. We hypothesized that it could have been there, but we've never physically seen anything until now.
Yeah, exactly.
Pam comes along, strips it, and here we are.
Right. I mean, there's plenty of evidence, historical interviews with colonists on the island, for example. They pointed to that location, in fact, as a place where they found aircraft wreckage of an aircraft that was there before they arrived. They arrived in 1938.
Yeah.
So, but without knowing the specific location, it would have been impossible for anybody to really see it or find it. You know, it's a big enough area and it's in a tough spot to actually go to. You know, it's in the shallows in a very murky area where the bottom is like quicksand. And it's, you know, not some place where you would scuba dive necessarily. It's kind of hard to access from the land or from the water.
I'm sure those challenges have been addressed or will be addressed during this expedition. How do you address those types of challenges for something that just physical access is going to be an issue?
Right. Physical access is an issue, but now we know exactly where to look.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're able to do scuba diving and so forth in that location. We're also able to do remote sensing. So we're going to be using magnetometry, sonar, as well as just old-fashioned physical probing to find the location of it. And then once we've outlined it, we've identified precisely where it is, then we can just basically suck the sediment off the top of it and hopefully identify it.
Yeah, well, let's get to that a little bit. Listen, we have a lot of nerds that listen to the show. People love this case. They come to it for different reasons. They're aviation geeks, they're archaeological geeks. I mean, just the list goes on and on. I might be the biggest one. I want to discuss some of the tech that you'll be deploying in an effort to sort of help you. You just touched on it to make identification. Can you discuss some of those technological methods and some of the analysis you'll be using to sort of figure this thing out, to make a determination one way or another?
Right. Well, I've already mentioned the magnetometer, and we have some other ideas as well. You see, we're working with a company called Recon Offshore. They're headquartered in Florida, and they are underwater archaeology specialists. And we've been talking about, the methodology of that, and they sent me their own document relating to the methodology. We're talking about using two different kinds of magnetometers, as well as a side scan sonar. This is connected with a global positioning system to identify, precise locations and gather data. We'll be doing a series of parallel track lines over the target area to outline it, starting with a 2.5 meter line spacing. And, we don't expect a lot of ferrous metal to be at that site, but there's going to be some. I think that the remote sensing will identify it or at least record it to some extent. Once we have that location and outline figured out as much as we can with remote sensing, then we actually go in and do a hydroprobe, which is basically a piece of PVC pipe with water pressure to probe down through the sediment and physically contact the object. And all that will be done systematically over a grid pattern such that we can identify precisely where the remains lie. And then we will start sucking sediment off the top of it to expose as much of it as we can in the time that we have, and hopefully to the extent that we can identify precisely what it is. I mean, if it's the Electra, it's going to be, I think, relatively easy for us to conclusion.
Just curious, have you talked to Rick Gillespie about this expedition? I'm sure that you have. What are his thoughts on you guys going out, taking this approach, looking at this target? Have you guys had conversations?
Well, I'm reluctant to speak for Rick Gillespie, and I don't think he really wants me to speak for him. But I can tell you that while he doesn't agree that Tria object is likely to be the Electra, he's not going to stand in our way. He believes in the scientific method too, and I think he would be happy actually if we found that it was the Electra, because it would basically be the final smoking gun proof that he'd been right all along, all the way since, since the 80s when he started proposing that this was the location. So I can't speak for him. He's going to have to speak for himself. But this is not a Tiger project. It's an ALI project, that is Archaeological Legacy Institute. We are quite eager to partner with Rick and with Tiger if that works out to the benefit of all of us.
Yeah,
So.
absolutely. No, I and that's to Rick's credit. Absolutely, of course. So for listeners of this show who, have heard over 100 plus episodes of Chasing Earhart and are well aware and well familiar with the castaway hypothesis in general, how they generally got there, I'm really interested in how this object got to this spot, particularly as it relates to the castaway hypothesis as a whole. What are your thoughts on how it may have ended up where it lies today, and how long do you think it's been there in that spot?
Well, I can tell you exactly what I think. In fact, I can point you to our documentation for it. So if you go to archaeologychannel.org/Taraya, that's TARAIA, you'll see in the biggest section of that page is the description of how we think the object that is the Electra became the Taraya object. So the scenario runs something like this. After a few days of sending out radio messages, the tide rose higher each day and eventually rose high enough so that it floated the airplane off the reef. At that point, it was subject to the impact of the waves. At that point, then the plane started to break off. Probably the outer wing section came off first, followed by landing gear, engines, and other parts of the wing sections. I think that probably what happened was that the fuselage remained mostly intact, the tail remained mostly intact, but the object, the remainder of the aircraft, floated around, got bounced around, and the currents floated it through the passage and into the lagoon. I think that's likely to have happened because, first of all, the prevailing winds and the currents would move it in that direction. And when the tide rises, water flows pretty forcefully into the lagoon from the ocean. So that probably would have happened within a very short period of time after the plane was lifted off and subjected to the wave action. I'm thinking that probably by about July 7th. Now, you may know July 2nd was the date of the disappearance. July 7th would have been about the date when the plane was lifted off the reef. The Navy planes arrived there looking for Earhart and the aircraft on July 9th. So I'm guessing that what happened to the aircraft happened between July 7th and July 9th.
Okay.
At the very least, the pilots of those search planes were not looking for a wreck. They were looking for an intact aircraft, which, of course,
Yeah.
was not visible at all at that time. So
Right.
in this scenario, then, the wreckage in the form of the fuselage and the still attached tail floats through the Tasman Passage across the lagoon and comes to rest alongside the Chorea Peninsula. And it would have floated for a time, but eventually the empty fuel tank would have filled up with water. It would have sunk to the bottom and become a dead weight on the bottom of the lagoon.
Yeah.
Now, that would have been pretty close to the location where we see the Chorea object in the satellite imagery. Not precisely, though. We see an object in the aerial photographs shot by the New Zealand military in 1938, which I think is very likely to be the same thing. It's a very, very reflective object. It's configured in a manner that would reasonably be the same object. And it's pretty close to that location, although not precisely at that location. But given the fact that there is a constant current going into the lagoon on a daily basis, it could have skidded across the bottom of the lagoon until finally it came to rest alongside the what now has become a sand spit near the tip of the Chorea Peninsula. Once
Yeah.
it became fixed there, then it would have changed the sedimentation dynamics of that specific spot at the location alongside the Chorea Peninsula.
Yeah.
In fact, to such an extent that after 1938, we have some good pictures of the peninsula in 1938. After 1938, that sand spit grew rapidly until it came to its present form approximately in the mid-80s. So over a span of about 40 years, it grew into its current shape. Now, that's after the Chorea Peninsula has been there for probably at least hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of years. And now, all of a sudden, we have a different configuration of the sand spit. So I think that could be the reason for that. And in that same process, the object would have become not only firmly embedded, but it would have become effectively part of that sand spit,
Okay.
entirely covered over and part of that geomorph, part of that landform.
What's the depth that we're talking about here is at where this thing lies potentially there? How
Very
far down?
shallow. I'm estimating between 2 and 5 meters below the surface.
Okay, so low. Okay, yeah, very low.
Yeah,
Interesting.
not deep at all. Only you can almost wade out and feel it if it were not covered. But it's
Wow.
very shallow. And that's one thing that maybe threw people off who were over there looking for it, because
Yeah.
it looks like it's a natural landform.
Yeah.
It looks like a landform that's been there for a long, long time.
Yeah. Maybe hiding in plain sight. Wow.
Yeah.
That's remarkable. That's remarkable. You just mentioned aerial shots, the 1938 New Zealand military aerial photographs. I want to ask about that in comparison to the 2001 Tiger helicopter footage that is also out there. How do those two support each other? How does that strengthen your hypothesis and kind of what you're looking at here?
Well, sure. The history of this starts with the satellite images, and then I started looking at other evidence. The Tiger Forum pointed me to the helicopter overflight video when someone in the forum made mention of what looked like a reflection coming from below the water at that spot. I thought that I was intrigued by that. So I went back to the video and looked at it very, very carefully. And then we now have a frame by frame version of that video, which shows what looks like a very much like a solar reflection coming from exactly, precisely the same spot as the Chorea object. And there's
Yeah.
exactly the same spot. Not only that, but if you look at it carefully, it's sort of an elongate shape oriented precisely at the same angle as the main body of the Chorea object. So
Yeah.
I think almost certainly it's the same object.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I was there, I said, in 2017, and I brought with me a drone. I got a lot of drone footage from high up above the island. At the time, we knew nothing about the Chorea object, but after learning about it, then I went back into that footage. And now we have images of the Chorea object from about 4 different angles in that footage. That was from 2017. Now, you asked
Right.
about the New Zealand imagery. Now, New Zealand was there in 1938. They flew a plane around the island. They got aerial photographs from every angle all around the island. I had a chance to look at those with some friends. We wanted to look and see if we could see anything that might look like the Chorea object in those pictures. Most of them don't show anything, but there are two frames from directly opposite direction that show an object which could be exactly the same thing from the north side and from the south side. It looks like the same thing. In fact, when I compare the images and rotate them, in fact, I know exactly, rotate them 141 degrees. The pictures were taken from 141 degrees apart. If you rotate the images 141 degrees and put them all side by side, they look just like the same thing. So
Jesus.
whereas if you see an object like that, or it could be a flaw in the photograph, but if you see it twice from two different directions, I don't think it's a flaw in the photograph.
Well,
That
yeah,
was in
absolutely.
1938.
God, wow. All right. I think I know the answer to this question. I think I know how to sort of explain it, but I'm going to play the
Okay.
devil's advocate as I do on this
Sure.
show. Here's
Okay.
that curveball that you were asking about
Okay. All
earlier.
right. Go for it.
All right. So a lot of people would crucify me if I don't ask this question. I'm certain of it. So just in plain terms, a lot of people might say, look, Nikumaroro has been done to death. How is this expedition different in terms of what you're trying to accomplish versus the previous expeditions out to Niku? I think I know what that answer is. I would love for you to explain to the listeners why this time is different and why this time is unique.
Well, we have a very narrow scope of work.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, we're not there looking randomly for something. We
Right.
see something in the satellite imagery. We know exactly where to go. We're going to go and we're going to probe that spot. We're going to excavate that spot. And we're either going to find the Electra or we're not. It's very simple.
Yeah.
We're not going to waste our time doing anything else because if we're right, it's going to lead to something much bigger. If we're wrong, then we won't have any reason to come back.
Yeah. Damn. Okay. That's
Yeah,
about as
I
cut and
mean,
dry as you can get. I
I mean,
love
it,
it.
yeah,
I love
it's
it.
different. It's very different. Of course, a lot of logistics are going to be the same, but the basic goal is quite different and very,
Yeah.
very tightly focused.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the team you've assembled for this, because I've been lucky enough to peek at the list of folks potentially joining you on this expedition. There are some dream interviews for me in this group, for sure. Jamie Limbach, I've wanted to talk to her for years, and we've tried to make it happen. I think we will soon. I just want to ask, you mentioned Dr. Tom King earlier. How does your collaboration with Tiger, just in general, and sort of your analysis of their research, right? How has that helped you approach this investigation? I mean, I'm imagining that that data that they've acquired over the course of 30 plus years has been invaluable.
What I want to make sure everybody understands is that we don't think that we're doing anything really that different. Yes, we're focused on this one object, but the context is something that was created by Rick Gillespie and Tiger. In all the work that they have done there, they have gathered an incredible body of evidence. Without that, we would not be able to even begin with this project.
Yeah,
So we're
absolutely.
basically standing on their shoulders, and I think what we're doing is sort of like the final step in a long research path that began back in the 1980s. The whole concept of Nikumaroro, the whole idea of how Amelia and Fred came to be there, what appears to have happened to them is something that's been built up and developed. This narrative has been developed over a long span of time, and I've followed it. I was on the island. I was there on a Tiger expedition. We're actually an institutional member of Tiger. So I give Rick Gillespie and his compatriots high marks for a long and persistent project through a lot of difficulties, suffering through a lot of criticism, a lot of mistakes along the way, which Rick acknowledges, but it's perfectly understandable. We wouldn't be anywhere without them. So I want to make sure that that's clearly understood. We're simply going another step to finally resolve the matter to a degree that is no longer a doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. All for that. Amen to that. I did want to ask you, I wasn't going to ask you this. You know, this is my first chance really getting a chance to sit down with you at length and talk to you about it. I'd love to just get your opinion and pick your brain on the post-loss radio signals, because I know you've gone through them. We went through them extensively for Vanished. Jen Taylor specifically went through them for Vanished during the Castaway series we did. What are your thoughts on the post-loss radio signals, and do they factor in any way to this particular object, or is that just another piece of information that Tiger's been able to put together?
Well, I think that the post-loss radio transmission information or evidence is compelling.
Yeah,
It's
agreed.
multifaceted, it's compelling, and that's, of course, one of the main reasons why Rick Gillespie and Tiger ended up focusing on Nikumaroro. With regard to this object, the only additional connection that I might make is that we can imagine Amelia and Fred in the aircraft sending out radio messages over a period of several nights, and the aircraft is sitting on the reef. I mean, we can imagine this scenario. Eventually, the transmissions stop. Why did they stop? Well, we think because clearly that the aircraft no longer could function to transmit the messages. That gives us a timeline with regard to how, when that might have happened. We got the timeline from that and from the date we know when the pilots flew over the island. So we have a sort of narrow window in which something must have happened. Beyond that, I really can't say that there's too much connection beyond what everybody already knows.
Well, another area I think I really wanted to ask you about, and we've touched on it, the sediment tonight. We've touched on it a couple, you've touched on it a couple times. We have talked so much at length. We talked with Tony Romeo, Tom Detweiler, Bill Snavely. I mean, anybody you can think of, we've probably had this question answered by them, but I want to get your take on it too. The effect that the sediment has on the actual target item, is that a benefit for you when it comes to preservation, or is that an enemy for you when it comes to preservation?
I think primarily a benefit.
Okay.
I think that the sediment would have protected the object to a certain extent from solar ray degradations, maybe some chemical, maybe some physical damage. Oftentimes in archaeology, we find that sediment is very protective and enables us to get preservation much better than it would could have happened if it had been just exposed without cover. So I think it's a benefit. It also holds it in place. It keeps everything associated, whatever parts are still there, all associated with one another in pretty much their original configuration. With one difference I might point out, I think the evidence is pretty good that the colonists on the island were mining the site for aluminum. And so I think that the site has been disturbed, and that should affect our interpretation of what we're looking at. So whereas you might expect to see something that looks more like an aircraft, of course, it's gone through a lot of damage from, natural forces, but it also, I think, has been affected by people just ripping pieces of aluminum from it and repositioning them at that location. So I expect that when we go there, that we'll find the Electra, but that the pieces are repositioned by the colonists. And so that makes it more difficult to directly interpret the object based on the imagery from above.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think I know the answer to this. Again, just love to get your take on it.
Sure.
What are the potential implications for aviation history and Earhart's legacy, not to mention Noonan's legacy, if the Turiya object is confirmed to be the plane? What are the implications in your eyes? What are your next steps if that happens?
Well, I can answer that last question most easily. The implication, that's something that's a matter of opinion, but the next step will be to go back and excavate the site, right? So we're working with a company called Recon Offshore, headquartered in Florida. They're experienced underwater archaeologists. They're used to excavating submerged objects, and they've had a really great track record. We're going to be approaching this archaeologically. I'm an archaeologist, right? So I see this as an archaeological project. So once we have identified that it's the Electra, assuming that's what it is, then we'll go back hopefully the following season with a full-scale archaeological team to expose it, document it, just as we would with a shipwreck, with the idea of gleaning from it as much information as we can about what happened, as well as looking forward to recovery of the artifacts and possibly even the wreckage itself in a following season. And that actually kind of begins a whole phase of work focused on what really did happen on the island. Because I think there's other physical evidence potentially available on the island as well. That would be another step in developing a more thorough narrative of what truly happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, which goes beyond the speculative phase where we're sitting right now.
One of the things we've discussed a lot on this show, with Buka specifically recently, is the idea of this interdisciplinary collaboration, or just fancy word of cross collaboration, cross theory collaboration. What is your opinion on how experts from different fields can come together to contribute to an investigation as big as this one? How do you do that?
Well, I don't know. My focus is on doing a scientific excavation of the site as an archaeologist. So I would bring Rincon Offshore and their archaeological team. Beyond that, there may be some advantage to bringing in people for other aspects of the research. And maybe there's other things to look at. We're very interested in what we call Camp Zero, for example. You know about Camp Zero, right?
I do, yes.
Okay. Where we believe Camp Zero is located, there's not been a single spade of earth recovered or moved from that archaeologically. So if Fred and Amelia actually camped at that location, there's a good chance that there's some debris there in the ground from that period of time, but it's not ever been excavated. So I think that could be a very important part of exploring the island to document the story that I was just talking about. Now, people can help us with that. Maybe they can't. I don't know. My idea would be to try to find a way to gather the evidence and then find the best possible team to accomplish that. Which could include other people who are currently involved with other projects. Maybe not. I don't know.
Well, as you mentioned at the top of the conversation, you've been doing this for a long time, and you've been involved in this case for a long time. You just mentioned what the next steps would be if you positively identified this aircraft as NR16020. I want to go a little bit beyond that. And this is just personal inflection, personal opinion. What do you believe should happen to the aircraft once it's found, regardless of where it's found? Let's say it's found deep in the ocean, 16,000 feet down. Let's say it's at Buka. Let's say it's at Niku. It doesn't really matter. I'm just curious, what are your thoughts? What do you think should happen to this aircraft if it's found and if it's recoverable?
Well, I do have opinions about that, but I think we should try to follow up the legal pathways. That aircraft originally was purchased by Purdue University and given to Amelia Earhart as a gift. She was on the faculty at Purdue University at the time.
That's right.
Purdue University has a strong claim to it, but I am not a lawyer, I have to point out, so I can't say. Someone has told me that basically finders keepers when you're out in the ocean. But here we're on in the country of Kiribati. We're on the land of Kiribati. Their government would have something to say about what becomes of the aircraft. As to what should happen to it, I think the two logical potential locations would be the Smithsonian, that would be one, and Purdue University would be the other one. I've actually already been in contact with both of them. They're aware of what we're doing, and there are ongoing discussions about what should happen. Of course, you have to physically be able to recover it,
And some of these cases, it might not be recoverable. It might be there, but not recoverable. That's
Well,
true.
yeah, and that's one of the objects of an excavation that we would do. So the first phase is identifying what it is. The second phase would be a full-scale archaeological excavation. One of the purposes of such an excavation, beyond simply the scientific documentation, would be to determine whether it is recoverable and by what means it could be recovered. So that would be an important question to address as we're exploring the object. But I think actually anything is recoverable if you have enough money, right? So, I mean,
Amen to that.
if we can send somebody to Mars, we can certainly recover the Chiraya object. But of course, finding the resources to do it, that could be the biggest question.
All right. Well, Rick, I've only got a couple more questions for you, and they're more
Sure.
opinionated discussion questions I
That's
think
fine.
people will enjoy. I wasn't going to ask you this, but I think since you mentioned it, I think it's fair game, and I think it's an important thing to talk about. You know, every time somebody puts some kind of attempts to put some kind of progress forward. I don't care about theory, so we'll just wipe that off the board. Just in general, I think there is a certain degree, especially with this case, especially with her status and who she was and what she means to history and all that, you're going to get a hefty amount of criticism when it comes to what you're doing. Privately, like, is that a factor to you? Or are you just, you know, you've been doing this for so long, or does it just not even matter to you at this point? It's like, look, we've got a task and
I don't
that's it.
know. I mean, there's two sides to me, right? Okay, so there's the human side, a person who has feelings and gets angry sometimes. And then there's the scientific side where I try to be rational. I mean, we all have, at least those two sides to our personalities. I have my own emotional reactions sometimes, but when it comes right down to it, most important to me is the rational side and really trying to find out what happened. I'm really interested in finding the truth. And I'm interested in being able to demonstrate the truth. And that to me is the most fulfilling thing. I don't really find it fulfilling to react emotionally to somebody's inane comment. Although as a human being, I sometimes am tempted to do that. I have to admit.
Before my final question of the night, I do want to follow up with something you said earlier, and because I think it's compelling, and I think people's ears will perk up when they hear it. You mentioned earlier, at least in regards to your investigation out at Nikumaroro, if you get out there and you determine it's not her aircraft, there's no reason to go back. Nikumaroro, as you know, has been visited multiple times.
I probably said too much. I probably went too far there, but for present purposes, that would be the answer. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess to just expand on that, and you don't have to comment on this if you don't feel comfortable doing that, but if, let's say, you go out there, we've talked about it being the aircraft and you having success there. Let's talk about the opposite. If you get out there and you determine it's not her aircraft, do you think Nikumaroro has been investigated enough, or do you think there's more here that we can or another team can look at that hasn't been touched already? I mean, it's just a, I guess, a general question, but I'm curious, and I know the audience will
Well,
be too.
my feeling on it is that the evidence that Nikumaroro was the final destination for Earhart and Noonan is compelling. I don't think any other explanation carries as much weight and has as much evidence behind it. So I think probably there is other evidence there. The aircraft had to go somewhere, right? Bob Ballard couldn't find it with his Nautilus ship in 2019, which kind of tells me that it's not down there. But who knows? It might be completely broken into small parts and becoming part of the coral reef. But that doesn't mean it can't be detected. Tiger has found pieces of metal along the edge of the reef in previous expeditions. When they went back, and they couldn't find them again, which is part of the frustration. But there are probably other things. I mean, we were there in 2017. We found stuff. Has anybody told you about the shoe that we found? Or
we
the
had heard
flashlight?
About that. We had heard about the flashlight and the shoe. Yes, we had heard about that.
And there's the Uka vial. You've heard about that? Okay. So there's stuff that was found there. And it was found in a place where clearly it was water deposited. And I'm pretty sure that those things were deposited there in 2015 by the cyclone. In fact, when we look at the satellite imagery, we can see the effect of the cyclone on the vegetation of the island. Even within a span of 2 months, it turned from this luxuriant vegetated area to an area that was torn up.
Yeah.
That was the time when this layer of stuff was spread out over that part of the island. And that included these objects, which to me are pretty good evidence and fit in very nicely with the Nikumaroro hypothesis. That shoe, for example, that's exactly the style Amelia wore.
Yeah.
It's her size. Yeah. Where else would that come from? The colonist women on the island between 38 and 63 weren't wearing stuff like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like I said, there's plenty of evidence. It's not smoking gun stuff, but it all adds up, right? So I think that there is more evidence to be had there. The main question is not whether there's more evidence, whether it might be advisable or useful to go back, but whether you could actually muster the resources to do it.
Well, just kind of as we exit tonight, we have a lot of young people that also listen to this show that listen for specific people that are going to be on, people that want to get into archaeology, that want to do what you do. I think if you listen to this conversation, when you play it back and when you hear it live, you'll hear that there's a very distinct passion in your voice. You sound like you love it so long after you've been doing this. What advice would you give those young folks who are maybe trying to get their degrees, they're young into their careers, they want to do this? Sustainability wise, what keeps you motivated for this?
I just have sort of an innate fascination with mysteries, and in particular with this mystery. I really think that we're very close to solving it.
Yeah.
And I don't think we can stop at this point. We have to take it to its logical conclusion. And it could, as you say, it could turn out that it's not the Electra. I don't know what the hell it would be if it's not, but we don't know until we go there. Now, as what we would say to young people, well, I didn't become an archaeologist to get rich, I can tell you that.
Right.
So if people are interested in making $1 million, I don't recommend that they get into archaeology.
Yeah.
If, on the other hand, they want to do something that is intellectually challenging and fascinating and something that can keep them excited for their entire life, I think it's a wonderful profession. There's a lot of archaeology going on. Most archaeology in this country is done by private companies like Recon Offshore, not by universities. There are university positions, but most archaeologists are not university archaeologists. They're out there in the private sector doing archaeology under contract. It is a viable career path, but I would recommend people do it out of their interest and their fascination and their passion rather than a desire to become financially independent.
Yeah, good advice. Okay, let's get out of here. Before we do, how can listeners of the show follow this expedition? What do you need? How can we help? And can you drop some, I know you dropped the website earlier, but can you drop the expedition website, any links, any social media you guys might have, any of that here?
Right, so the main place, and we try to put it in this one place, archaeologychannel.org/Taraia, T-A-R-A-I-A. And from there, you can find all kinds of stuff. Our pitch video is on that site. Or link to that site. We have a link there where you can make contributions if you want to help us in our fundraising effort, not necessarily to get us to the island, but at least to help us along the way as we're spending our resources in our fundraising effort.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the main place. We tried to make it all accessible from one location.
Archaeologychannel.org/TARAIA. We will have links to everything we discussed tonight in the show's notes for the episode. Rick, again, I'd wanted to have this conversation for a long time. Thank you so much for doing this. I know you're busy. Thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to talk with you about it.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.